there, boys and girls. How's everybody out there doing today? It is a very, very weird time in the world right now. And no, I'm not talking politics. I'm just talking everything in general, where now we've got calm water. We've got a lot of fish out there. There's just so many things going on every week that, and I would say one of the big things right now, if I was going to highlight something that literally I might be the only person in the world that knows about it or that actually correlates it all with other information. Let's put it that way. We had a guy come in on a random squirrel topic that I haven't really seen much of in the last few years, because when Braid in Line first came out, it was very common for people just to put it on a reel with no binding agent. They didn't put monofilament underneath it, or they didn't use black tape. They would just put the braid on the spool because that's what they had always done with line.
Been there, done that.
And it creates a weird phenomenon because much of the time, braid doesn't stick to a metal spool, especially on older reels like the old Penn Spinfishers and a lot of the Mitchell stuff and all that. Some of the spools actually had kind of grooves in them to help with the strength, reduce weight, help with the strength, material cost. But we had a guy come in the other day, and I hate it when they lie to me. It just starts getting me annoyed right away. I said, who put the line on this reel? Well, you guys did. I said, it's impossible. I said, I can tell this line's at least a year and a half, 2 years old. And we were burned down at that point. We weren't even open for business. I said, and I don't remember selling an Abu with a Shimano on it. You know, this, it just didn't look right. But he wants to play on my sympathies. Well, I'm your customer and I want you to help me. Well, I was going to help you anyway, but saying dumb stuff does not lend me to want to help. So I was busy. I was waiting on like three people at once. So I told him, I said, just, you know, he was working with one of the other guys behind the counter, and they were talking about the drag wouldn't work on the reel. And no matter what he did, the drag wouldn't work. Well, they played with it and tested it. He says, oh, well, it's kind of working now. And he says, well, I guess it's like a car. It doesn't work until you take it to the mechanic, and then everything seems to run fine. I said, that's not it. I know what it is. I can see it from here. I said, just wait a minute. You know, you have to wait. As soon as I get to one of these other people, I'll get to you. Well, I finished up what I was doing, walked over, grabbed the spool, and spun the line on the spool. Just twisted it.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, it's going to appear like the drag doesn't work because you can't stop the line from going out. He never noticed the line was going out, but the spool wasn't turning. And we had been through all this stuff about, oh, you would put the line on. I said, I know there's no way in heck I did this because I'm not that dumb. I do it right. I've been always, since the third time I spooled a reel with this, I've been doing it the right way. All my guys do it the right way. So it evolved around, he put the line on, didn't know what he was doing. So I had to transfer it off. And what I can't believe was, he fished with it for over a year like that. And so the weird part is, you take it off, you put it on another spool. Then you got to put it on another spool. Then you can put it back on his reel. So we took all the line off, put it on a spool, then took that line, put it on another spool again, so that way it would reverse it. Because all the line on the top was faded. It's getting old. I don't think it messed with the strength. But when you got down a little while, it wasn't white-gray line. It was bright yellow line. So if you just put it on a spool and put it back, it's exactly the same. But if you put it on a spool and then put it on another spool.
Oh, that makes sense. All right, I got you now.
Now you put it back on and it's upside down.
Yeah.
So once I got the line off of his, I wrapped it up because he was a little low on line. So I just did about 8 or 10 wraps with the black tape to build up a little base for it. Now the black tape sticks to the metal spool. The braided line will dig in and stick to the black tape. Now you have a binding agent, something to tie them together. And I reversed the line for it. He got a brand new line on it. And I didn't charge him because I didn't do anything except a few wraps of black tape. Took me a few minutes, but no big deal. But he couldn't believe I wasn't charging him for it. But I tried telling him, like a kid in today, he had a conventional reel, one of the level wind. It has the little gizmo that goes side to side. But it was almost like a squitter. Do you remember those?
Yes, I do.
So it's about a 2-inch spool, about 3 inches wide. They're exceptionally hard to cast. If you used to only have thrown a spinning reel, you have no idea how hard a bait caster, small conventional, is to cast and how much weight it requires to carry the line out there. And these people, they buy these reels at a chain store, pick a name, including the, all the chain stores for fishing tackle. But what's amazing to me is they sell people this stuff, and then they give them a bunch of braid and line, and they put it on a spinning rod. Not one of the things match up. Conventionals, bait casters, and braid are not good until you're very good with them, because it's very hard to get knots out of braided line. Monofilament's much easier to get the knots out of. But he goes out, throws it one time, backlashes, bird nest it to the point it had to be cut all the way down to the bottom to get the line off. It took almost 10 minutes to get the line off the darn thing. Say, well, I want some more braid on there. I'm like, no, you don't. And I have a little test where I show people. I take spool. He's wanting 50-pound braid. I wanted to put 25 mono on it because that's the better line for that reel, especially if you're going to learn to cast it, do things like that. So I showed him. I took 25-pound test mono, and I take a pair of scissors, and we hold the line out, and then you just rub the scissors back and forth, chafing it with the blade part of it, because you don't want a knife. You don't want it that sharp. You just want something a little bit sharp. So you take the edge of the scissors, you rub it back and forth to see how long it takes you to wear through the line. Well, with 25 mono, it probably took 3 or 4 seconds. With the 50-pound braid, it took about a half a second to maybe a second to wear through it. Goes right through. And no one will believe that. But I show it to them, and then I go, wait a minute, that can't be right. We got to do that again. And I do the braid again, and they're like, that doesn't make any sense. And so what you're not understanding is braid is not better than mono, and mono is not better than braid. They're simply different. Different uses, different aspects, and I'll put 25 mono against 40-pound braid any day. Any day. I'll give you a 40-pound braid. I'll do 20-pound, 25-pound mono. I'll outpull you. People won't believe it, but it's actually true. And it's these weird things that you learn after decades of selling tackle and investigating all this stuff, which brings me to my point, by the way.
Oh, wait. There was a point. Okay.
There is actually a focus to this.
Let me get my pad out.
Yeah. Well, it's really cool. Every few years. Now, it could be 2 years in a row. It might be a year. And then 10 or 12 years later or 8 years later. There is no pattern to this. There is only when it happens. And all of the stars and the sky and the moon all have to shine brightly, and you need to stand on one foot, hop around the circle, and say, Uma digga, Uma digga, Uma digga, 4 times as you're spinning for this to all take place. What has to happen is we have a year where we don't get hardly any rain, but we get good cloud cover and very cool weather. And believe it or not, 2022 has been a very cool year by Florida standards. So without the rain, the water in the harbor eventually gets flushed out and basically becomes the same as the Gulf of Mexico. You know, there's no real difference. When you leave Charlotte Harbor from the reef all the way on out to Boca Grande Pass, it looks the same. It's basically the same water. It's been mixed enough and recycled enough that it's the same thing. So when a fish is around Boca Grande Pass, if they go through it, they're not hitting a freshwater barricade and going, ooh, I don't want to be here, and turning around and leave, because people always tend to think fish stick their head out of the water and go, oh, look, the lighthouse at Boca Grande Pass. Oh, I reckon those trees at Cayo Costa. No, they're underwater. They only see what's in front of them. So as they go along, the reason a lot of fish don't come into the harbor is they might hit the pass, and then you have that outgoing tide, and it's pushing fresh water at them and just different water. Let's put it that way. Could be a little bit fresh, brackish, whatever. And they turn around and head back out. But when the water's kind of the same, they don't know to turn around. There's no, oh my God, I shouldn't be here. This is, hey, let's check this area out. They're underwater. They can't tell if they're in the Gulf of Mexico, the harbor. They don't know. They just know what the water is. So what happens is every few years, the water in the harbor and the Gulf of Mexico get about the same temperature. They're about the same salinity. All this stuff happens, and we get a big, every year in the Gulf of Mexico, we have millions or billions of squid hatched. But they don't come into the harbor because as they come around the pass, they go, oh, this isn't the right place, and they go back out. Now, these tiny baby squid are, including the tentacles, about an inch to 4 inches long. Little itty-bitty guys. And to avoid bigger predators, they come shallow. They want to get up close to shore. You notice there's a gazillion bait fish, and they're in 10 inches of water, 12 inches of water, where they can get up to 2 or 3 inches to get away from predators. Well, a lot of the small fish and small creatures try to get up in those shallows to avoid, because in the Gulf, we've got bonita, tuna, sailfish. We've got, you know, all these major predators out there and all the mackerels and everything else. And they're mostly open water fish. They don't really like being that close to shore. So you get a lot of these smaller creatures that know if they go shallow, they're still going to have predators, but they've eliminated so many of these other ones. But as these baby squid all came into the harbor, and it was about 2 months ago we first noticed them. And so I was waiting to see, is this going to do what it normally does? And what it normally does is bring in a huge amount of mackerel, huge amount of cobia, brings the sharks in. We have a phenomenal fishing year. Now, if you're going out right now and fishing against the mangroves, this has nothing to do with that. This is all outside of the sandbar stuff, middle of the harbor things, because that's where these squid are going to be. If we get an extreme southwest wind and the water came up, we had 3 or 4 feet of water on the flats, you are going to see some of these baby squid on the flats. Now, with all these squid, it's a tremendous amount of food for them. I almost never use squid for bait in the harbor because most of the time, the only thing that eats it is catfish. But right now, all of the mackerel, sharks, tarpon, I had a list here, cobia, all these other fish, keying in on these baby squid. But at the same time, they're opportunistic feeders, and these squid are providing them with great mouthfuls. There's a turtles hatching right now. And yes, for all you do-gooders, life isn't a freaking Disney movie. If it's smaller than you, you eat it, no matter how cute it is. You ever see one of these little baby squid? One of the cutest things you've ever seen in your life. They eat them like they're candy. We call stingrays cobia pez dispensers. Why? Because as the stingrays are swimming along, and they're just now at the end of the cycle, they're about another month left in this, where the stingrays all pile into Charlotte Harbor to give birth. And they're giving all these baby tiny stingrays are coming out of the mama, and fish are following behind them, eating them as they come out. They're great food. You know, babies, nobody wants to hear it. They're awesome food, and they don't fight back. So every creature on the planet wants to eat babies. So whether it's turtles, the stingray hatch, the tiny baby squid hatch, We've got all this stuff happening in the harbor, and it's working out to be an amazing fishery. And this goes from near coastal all the way up through the harbor, and it's a very rare event. I've only seen it maybe 4 or 5 times out of the last 4 decades. It's very rare it happens, but it's happening now, and it's still going on. You've still got a few weeks to get in on this. Now, if you use a cast net, you're cast netting bait, and you see some of these little squid, put them in your live well with the bait as well. Now, for these squid, the only way they really work is under a bobber. They don't have any way of supporting the hook in the water. A fish is swimming very vigorously to get that hook, leader, and line going through the water. Well, the squid can dart, and they're very quick, but they just don't have that overall continuous power to keep that hook up. So you got to put them under a bobber. Now, here's the problem. You really probably want to be 4, 5, 6 feet below the surface with them. You can't cast that. So if you got these squid and you're out in the middle of the harbor, you're looking for cobia, king mackerel, tarpon, whatever, you put them on about a 2-aught hook, hook them through the nose part, and then put a bobber on. Now, you're going to have to set that bobber with your squid on over the side of the boat and then move the boat away from the bobber. You can't cast that rig away from the boat. So this is something you do while you're drifting or before you anchor up. Now, if you've got a decent current, you can anchor the boat. You can even put some chum bags in the water. But when you got those little squid, put them about 4 to 6 foot below a bobber, throw them over the side of the boat, and let it drift away from you or physically move the boat away from them. Because you just can't cast that much line effectively at all. But awesome bait, amazing amount of fish in the harbor, all because the weather aligned right, the salinity in the harbor and the Gulf equalized out, and the squid get lost and come into the harbor. Is that kind of cool or what?
It is. It's a lot cool. And we're seeing fish that you don't normally see further up, like the Eljo Bean area I know pretty well, and I get a lot of reports from there. They caught some huge cobia there last week.
And a lot of that has to do with squid hatch. And king mackerel all the way up to the 41 bridge.
To the 41 bridge, king mackerel. Imagine that.
Guys were saying, oh, we caught this Spanish. We got this big Spanish mackerel. I'm looking at the picture going, well, you're close. That's king mackerel. It's not a Spanish mackerel. But it happens so rarely. And literally, it's all the stars and moons aligning, the wind, the sun. Everything has to be in this just right zone. Kind of makes me crazy because I hear about how great things were years ago. And that's 100% garbage. In the 70s, this country was so polluted because people didn't realize what we were doing to it. You know, the 70s really were a learning time. Okay, this is bad. We can't do this anymore. And we had to learn how to fix it. So all you eco-idiots, kiss my old white wrinkled patootie, because this country is so much better than it was when I was in middle school now than it was then. It's beyond belief. You have no idea what's happened.
I was in Cleveland in the 70s when the Cuyahoga River caught fire.
Yeah, rivers.
And we all went out on the bridges to watch the river burn.
Yeah,
because there
rivers
was so
would
much
catch fire.
Yeah, there was so much pollutant in the water in the 70s.
And they say, well, you guys are horrible people, and your generation killed everything. No, but we were learning. And did we kill a lot? Yes. But we had to figure it out. No one had ever done what my generation was doing before. You know, there was never so many people before. We invented all these medicines, so people actually lived. How would you like to, everybody always says, I want to go back to the 1800s. If you had 10 kids, you're lucky if 2 or 3 of them made it to 20 years old. Really lucky. I mean, it was not uncommon for people to have a kid, and in the first few years, the kid died. That was just normal life. And that's before funeral homes and coroners and all that. People would, when somebody passed away, they would clean them up, bring them in the living room, put them there, everybody come, say goodbye, cry a bit, then you take them out, bury them, and you go on. it was a hard life. You guys are wusses, pussies. I mean, peacocks. This is just, life is not easy until the last 40 years. But my generation saw the mistakes we were making and severely tried to fix it. And I got to give people credit. Yes, were we destroying the planet? Yes. Did we really know we were doing it? No. Did we figure it out and try and change it? Yes. All you eco idiots want to do is, oh, I'm going to carry a cloth bag instead of a paper one. Really? So anyway, back into the fishing. Everything's going good. In the 90s, there was no fish here. You could fish for a month and not catch a redfish. Snook were almost non-existent. By the end of the 90s, it was some of the most amazing fishing I've ever seen. From started getting good around 96, 97, and just got just amazing all the way through about 2002. And then it started to decline, got a little better again. And then the last couple of years, we've been on a decline again. Now, combinations of red tide, tournaments, this, that. The number one culprit, and this is hard for people to understand, is silt in the water. That's the number one problem we have. It's not, it's kind of pollution, but it's mostly just dirt, silt. All the, you know, the gasoline and everything else that runs off the road going in there is bad, but that's not the worst of it. The worst of it is simple suspended solids, little bits of sand, dirt, clay, all these things that block the sunlight that doesn't allow grass to grow. And this mostly happens because we have free-running ditches out in front of your house. The water runs off the street into the ditch, goes down, hits a storm drain, goes to a creek or a river, and that all ends up in the harbor. And what this just really dirt in the water does is it blocks the sunlight. And if you don't have sunlight, plants don't grow. So all the time, all summer long in the fall, if we have a lot of rain and a lot of runoff, it blocks the sunlight from getting to the seagrass. And when you don't have sunlight, the seagrass all dies off. Now, a number of years ago, not that many, maybe 10 years ago or so, we had a two-year drought. Do you remember the drought in Cape Corals? The canals were drying up.
Yep,
they didn't
do.
Think they were going to have water to fight fires. Everything was going to hell in a handbasket, literally.
Right, and we had all kinds of restrictions on watering your lawn. You had to know what your address was and what day you could water on and all the rest of it. We haven't seen that in a while.
You know what the opposite effect of that was? Seagrass everywhere in the harbor. You go out in the middle of the harbor, the water was clear and nice, and you would see plants coming up 4 or 5 feet off the bottom. And it took 6 months for the water to start clearing up because we had had a lot of rain before that. And then the rains just stopped, didn't come for almost 2 years. And as the water got clearer, we got more seagrass, more all different kinds of vegetation in the harbor. From the middle of the harbor up to the grass flats were covered in vegetation. Now, hear all these people say, the boaters are tearing up the seagrass and the pollution and there's too many tournaments and all this and all that. Oh, quit whining and get a freaking clue. Then let's look at Kings Highway. Kings Highway, to me, is a beautiful bit of modern engineering. It's absolutely amazing. It looks like big ditches, but what it has is deep water sections. Then they brought it up shallow and put a whole bunch of vegetation, all different plants in there. So the water stores itself in the deep area. As it comes up, flows through the grasses, goes into a drain, goes to another deep area, and the deep areas act as settling ponds. The grasses and all the cattails and all this act as filters for the water. By the time it gets to the bottom end of Kings Highway, the water is 50-80% clearer than it was where it came into there. It's a beautiful piece of engineering. Simple, and it works. If ditches were like that all over the state, from wherever water was going to go in there, deep water settling ponds, little skinny areas with great vegetation that should be using duckweed and cattails and all these things, hyacinth, all these things that make filters. We would have the harbor loaded with seagrass half the year because that's the way it's supposed to be. Because when we get a lot of rain, the brown tannins and stuff cover up a lot of the sunshine and kill a lot of the grass. But that's the way of the harbor. That's the way it's always been. It's the way it always should be. It should never be full of grass all year, all the time. That's eco-idiot talk. But the right balance, that's what it is. And we can do this simply by changing our ditches. Do tournaments take too many fish? Yes. Are there too many people fishing? Probably, but I had three kids. How many kids did you have? Did you have one or two? You have a right to complain. If you had three or more, shut up, you idiot. You're the problem. You know, too many people. So if you want to blame it on somebody, blame it on idiots like me who had three kids. You know, that's the truth of it. You had what, one kid?
One kid. So I can say, Frank, shut up.
You can look at me and go, you piece of junk. You know, you couldn't control yourself? Two kids would have been great. But that's kind of the way it goes around. That's a long way to get about why there's the little squid in the harbor and why the fishing is so amazing.
Okay.
We were just...
I'm waiting for the turn here.
Yeah, well, that was kind of it. But the whole idea is we have a gazillion baby squid in the harbor. Everything lined up right. We're going to have one of these amazing fishing years. Now, the neat part about the side effect of this is without red tides this last October, November, we're going to have a much bigger redfish hatch. So as these baby redfish are growing up and fish are concentrating on these other forms of food, not on them for a form of food, as the baby squid appear and all the glass minnows and all that, it takes pressure off of a lot of the other fish. So we should see in the next year to 2 years a marked increase in redfish, snook, probably even sea trout. One of the reasons the sea trout populations are so low is because the mullet populations are bad. Too many purse seiners in the Gulf taking all of the mullet that go out there to spawn before they spawn. When you take two crabs in Boca Raton Pass, you're out there tarpon fishing right now. And I'm going to go over a little bit of tarpon fishing in the past. But if you take two of those crabs, that's 200 or 300 that's not there next year. So steel yourself to put a half a dozen crabs in your live well. You get down to 3 or 4, get a few more. Do not have 2, 3, 4 dozen crabs in your live well because you can, because you shouldn't. You're killing next year's hatch. Yes, it's a bit extreme, but it's true. Use what you need, not what you want. Do that with everything. World will be a lot better place. But cobia is one thing I wanted to talk about. Guys are actually going out to target cobia. Cobia is not considered a targetable species in Charlotte Harbor most years because they're so random. It's a bycatch. It's a luck of the draw. You know, you flip a coin and all of a sudden, bam, here's a cobia. That's so cool. But now you can actually target them. The Alligator Creek Reef is probably the best learning grounds for it. But every marker has a chance of having cobia around it. And if you're looking for where might they be, look at marker number 5. Look at the Alligator Creek Reef. Look at marker number 1. Marker number 2. Now, 1 is the one that's about 2 miles out from Ponce de Leon Park. Big 4-posted marker, green. Number 2 is not, there is 150 number 2 markers in Charlotte Harbor. We are talking about the actual Peace River markers. So marker number 2 is about halfway between Port Charlotte Beach and Punta Gorda. It's a 4-posted marker, red things on it. It is not the ones in Fisherman's Village or in your private canal. Those are all private markers. They are not the actual Peace River. One sits way out in front of Ponce de Leon Park. 2 sits up there. Why am I being specific about these spots? Because cobia want to go from one food source to another. and marker 5 is the turn. If they're coming in from Boca Grande Pass, which is where they would come in from, going along to get in front of Bull Bay, Turtle Bay, they run into the sandbar at Cape Hayes. They're going to follow that sandbar out till it gets a little deeper, 4, 5, 6 foot of water. That puts them almost out at marker number 5. That's why marker number 5 is key to this. You know where 5 is. There's going to be a vast amount of cobia coming around from 5 to the sandbar at Cape Hayes. Now, from there, you got the hole in front of Pirate Harbor where a lot of the shrimpers dump whatever trash they find in there. Then you have the middle holes. Then you have the Alligator Creek Reef, and then the 20-foot hole above that. And just off the 20-foot hole is marker number 1. 4 pilings, heavy overhead structure. So it holds a lot of bait. A lot of things hang out there avoiding predators, namely small food. Same with Alligator Creek Reef. They hide in the reef. Marker 5 is a turning point, but marker 1 is a food source. Alligator Creek Reef, food source. Marker number 2, food source. Where are the fish going to be? If you're not finding them at marker 1 or the Alligator Creek, you want to go in line between the reef and the next marker. That would be a food source. If you're driving down the road and you're taking a trip, now, if you're not me, because I actually do this goofy stuff, just turn off the interstate or the road and go travel around the backwoods somewhere, and then I'll come back. And, okay, I'm going to make a little time and drive down the interstate again. But you would go from the interstate, basically going from one gas station slash restaurant, food source, fuel source, to another. But me, I tend to meander around. Now, there are fish that follow my example and don't stay with the direct path. They go all over the place. But 7 or 8 out of 10... are literally going to swim from where they have to turn, marker 5, along that deeper channel, and you'll see it on the chart, to the Pirate Harbor hole, the middle hole, Alligator Creek Reef, 20-foot hole, over to marker 1, and then over to marker 2. Known food sources. Why would you expend the energy to go meandering around unless you're a little nuts the way I am? You know, if you're not a wackadoodle, you're going to spend as little energy as possible going from one food source to the other. So, how do you fish for them? I'm getting myself lost here.
Right. How do you fish for them, Frank?
Okay. How do you fish for them? If I was going to go to the Alligator Creek Reef, and this is one of the best places to learn cobia fishing, and there's a variety of lures, bait, things you can do. But for the first phase, I'm going to go by the Alligator Creek Reef and either be at the north end or the south end. If the tide's coming in, I'm going to the south end, anchor up my boat a good cast away from the pilings. I don't want to be right by the pilings because if I hook a fish, he's wrapping the pilings on me. I want to be where I can just cast towards those pilings. And I mean a good long cast, because if I pull the fish 5 feet towards me, he can't wrap the piling. If he takes off on a big run, hopefully it's not at a piling. So to avoid the pilings, I'm going to anchor the boat back as good cast as far as I can and still be able to cast at the piling. And there's 2 pilings, one on each end of the reef. If the tide's going out, I'll be at the north end of the reef because I want the water coming from me towards the reef, specifically the 2 pilings. Now, if there's a boat there, I just go off to one side and I anchor more than a cast away where I can cast sideways over at those pilings again. The pilings are kind of key because no matter how big a fish is, there's something bigger wanting to eat you. That's just the way life goes. And you got to add eagles into there, ospreys. You got fish, you know, creatures coming from above, creatures coming from below. Around that reef right now, you got a lot of Goliath grouper, say 30 to 80 pounds. You've got black drum in there, 20 to 60 pounds. You've got cobia there ranging from about 26 inches up to about 72 inches. So some really cool fish. and throw in some mackerel cruising by, a few trout, tarpon. I mean, a lot of sharks coming by. So this is a food source. This is a stopping point where they're going there to try to eat something. Now, if you're lucky, they're not coming there to eat you. But most things aren't that lucky. So the cobia are going to be hanging around those pilings, cruising the reef up and down, looking for food, going back to hang around a piling, because if a predator comes, they can play ring around the rosy. They can dodge around the pilings. Always when you're a wild animal, you want to avoid being eaten. The object is stay alive, which means having a place to hide. Best bet. Second bet, running in open water. More tiring, not as effective. Swimming around a piling, much more effective. So that's why those cobia are going to be hanging around those pilings. Now, if there's a few boats there, don't force your way in. You can get there the next time, or go down to the other end of the reef and anchor up current from the pilings and do the exact same thing. You're going to look in line between the pilings, get the straight line there, go about 20 feet outside of that to drop your anchor, because you've got the stuff built up that they dump for the reef. Then every 30 feet is a cluster of three reef balls right on the outside edge of that. And if you drop your anchor on that, you're not getting it back. And anchors are expensive today. So give yourself a good 20 feet outside of the reef to drop your anchor. Now, when you drop your anchor, let the anchor line out so that now you're within casting distance of one of the pilings on the trailing end of the water reef. So if the tide's coming out, this would work on the south end. Tide's coming in, you'd do this on the north end. Now, it only allows you to cast at one of the markers, not both of them. But it still allows you the same, close to the same opportunity. Because, as I said, cobia cruise up and down the reef. They're looking for food, which could be crabs, small fish, squid, you name it, or whatever there is. But when they get to the other end, they're going to circle those pilings for a while. That's their hidey spot. That's their, I'm going to lay up for a minute. And then they go back looking for food. But you can get them while they're going back and forth. You can get them when they're circling the pilings. This is something you can do if you properly place your boat. Now, if you drop the anchor and your boat starts going way the other way, first rule of anchoring, don't fall in love with where you anchored. So many people drop their anchor, they put up a mailbox. They got FedEx delivering packages there because they've moved in. It only takes a couple minutes to pull the anchor up, move it over one way or another. So now you're actually, and you might even have to go to the other side of the reef to get the correct, drop back from your anchor so you can cast at a piling. But you'll figure that out after you drop the anchor the first time. The first one is always, let's see what happens. The next one, you should be much better. So once you've got that, you can throw gold spoons at the pilings or just out over the reef. Probably the most effective bait right now is bucktails. Whether it's a flare hawk, whether it's a bucktail jig with a ribbon tail worm trailer, whether it's a jerk bait. Now, jerk baits are the flukes that you would use for bass fishing. They come in all different sizes, from 3-inch all the way up to like 10 or 12 inches, whichever one makes you feel the most comfortable. Now, if you're doing bait, I'm going to have one line. Average low tide water there is 12 foot. High tide's around 14. So I'm going to have a crab, preferably a blue crab. And if I've got a big one, let's say he's about 8 inches across, I'm going to grab him. I'm going to tear the top shell off. I'm going to break him in half, put a hook on there to expose all that meat. I'm going to hang him about 6 to 8 foot below a bobber, which means, again, you got to put it in the water and drift it back. Now I'm going to put in the other piece or a bait fish about 3 feet from the surface. Now you can use shrimp. You can use bait fish. You can use crabs, whole chunks. You can use frozen sardines, frozen mullet cut into chunks, frozen ladyfish cut into chunks. I use a lot of Spanish sardines for this, but I've got one down deeper, I've got one up by the surface, and I'm just letting them sit there. Now, because we got baits out and they're just sitting there, you get a little bored. Now, you might want to just sit back and have a drink or a cigarette or, you know, read a newspaper, but you're actually there to fish. So now let's grab a lure and just start casting, not where your bait are. Every 10th or 20th cast, I will throw close to one of my floats. Why do I have them on a float? Because they're not buried in the mud on the bottom. They're where the fish can see them. Sometimes I will literally, if I got 12 feet of water, I will put the bobber up at 11 foot, just so the bait's a little off the bottom. The other one's still up there three and a half feet below the surface to get any of the fish swimming close to the top. The other one's down so it can get those other ones. But usually 6 to 8 feet is good enough. But occasionally I go 8 to 10. Now, this is a matter of interpretation. But while they're out there, I don't want to throw that lure constantly past my bobbers. You're going to scare the fish off. It's like throwing a rock in the water if you're doing it over and over and over again. And you wouldn't sit out there throwing rocks at your bobber expecting to catch fish. It makes no sense. But occasionally, and I mean every 20 cast, I'll cast it over close to where my baits are to draw attention to it. That splashing of the lure hitting the water, it may catch me a fish. It may just bring attention to one of my baits. But over and over again is scary. Every once in a while can be a curiosity. So I'm going to work the other areas, casting where my bobbers are not. And I just pitch them out, reel them in. One of the things to do when you're cobia fishing is learn to count. You got a gold spoon on it. You throw it out, hits the water, you start reeling it in, bring it back right under the surface. Now you throw it out and it hits and you wait a bit and you just start reeling in. You get a good hit or you catch a fish. How far down were you? How do you replicate that? You have no idea where you were. This is where a little discipline in jigs and spoons comes in handy. As you cast, going through the air, it hits the surface, you see the splash, do not close the bail. Count 1,001, 1,002, 1,003, 1,004, close the bail and start to reel in. Then you might want to cast as soon as it hits the water, reel it in. You might want to count to 2. You might count to 8. What you're doing is figuring the average lure falls about 2 feet a second. Some might be 3 feet a second or a foot and a half a second, but 2 foot's about an average. But if you count it and then start reeling and you get the fish or get a hit, you can replicate it. You can do it again. That's how most of these guys are out fishing you. They're literally counting it down so they know where they were when the fish hit. Because if you throw it out and reel it in, and then the next time you throw it out, let it sink down, and you bring it in, get a fish or get a hit, you have no idea where you were. Now you got all this testing goes on again. If you simply counted it down, and remember, okay, I was at 4 count, 8 count, whatever it was, you can get back to that same place where the fish was and probably catch that fish. But if you don't know where you were, how do you get there again? Make sense?
Makes good sense to me. Yeah, and I think what you'll find with cobia is they're all going to be pretty much clustered at certain depths because that's where they're finding their food. That's where the light is right for them. So, you know, they're going to go to where they want to be, and you have to figure out where is it that they want to be.
Exactly. So let's say you go out fishing for cobia, and we did this anchor thing, and we're at the reef. It could be in one of the holes. It could be up by some of the other markers. But I never recommend anchoring by 5. Every idiot in a big boat wants to run right by that marker. Try to stay at least a half a mile away from it. Because if the boat's 26 to 80, 100 foot long, they're all going following that path. And you don't need to be there getting your butt waked and waked, being mad at them because they're following where they're supposed to be. Stay away from it. But, all right, I'm at the reef. I'm anchored up. And before I got there, I got lucky and I cast netted some white bait or thread fins, some small bait fish. Could be pinfish, could be anything. I've got them in my live well. I stopped at the bait shop over at Fish and Frank's, and I had 2, 3, 4 dozen shrimp, whatever it was. But I've got some shrimp in my live well and some bait fish. Now, the water's being pumped in, circulated in there, and then it goes through a drain and goes out the back of the boat. All those fish are putting smell into that water. And you're at anchor, and all of a sudden you look behind the boat, and there's a cobia just hanging out right behind the boat. Why is he there? Notice, their nose is always where the live well is dumping out. The little scales coming off the bait fish, the little pieces of shrimp, all this smell is being taken from your live well, dumped out the drain, and going in there. And the cobia smell that. Remember, the average fish has the same smell, sight, and hearing as a dog, which we all know a dog can follow you around the room where your skin cells landed. So picture that in the fish. So they're smelling that. Now, what I do then is I reach into the live well and very slow with very limited arm movement. Picture when a eagle, an osprey, a seagull, a tern, go down to get something out of the water. They have their wings extended out. They're flapping down. They grab something and they fly off. Big wings out. That's danger for any creature who knows a bird. When their wings are out, you don't want to be around them. Keep your arms in. Stay down low. Go to your live well. Take one out. Put it on the hook. Free line. If it's a smaller shrimp, a 1/0 hook. If it's a bigger bait fish, maybe a 4/0 hook. I want 30 to 60 pound leader, but I'm going to use whatever I've got, to a regular rod, no weight, no bobber. Now, once I get that bait rigged up, if somebody else is with me, I will hand them the rod, have them put it on the bait in the water on the outside of the boat, away from where the fish is. Don't put it anywhere close to the fish. Get it on the line and go back into your live well, take a couple of bait fish and a couple of shrimp. Very easily stand up and toss a bait fish between the cobia and the boat where he's smelling that coming from and see if he eats it. Might not eat the first one. If the bait fish goes by and he doesn't eat it, pitch a shrimp in there. See if he eats that. If he doesn't eat it, do another bait fish. He'll probably eat the second or third one. Now, once he eats it, you want to put whatever back and throw whatever it was that he ate. Then take the bait that's on your line and drop it in the same way as you toss that other one, keeping not a lot of slacking. You want just the bait to hit the water and have the line and everything out of the water as much as possible. And he will just sit there, open his mouth, and boom, grabbed it. You got him.
I tell you, the most frustrating thing is to have a cobia come up to the boat and you throw all kinds of stuff at him and he's not interested. Because, like you said, he's interested in what's coming out of that live well.
And one of the tricks to it is sometimes when I'm tossing right in front of him, they kind of get the idea something's wrong here.
Yeah.
So what I do then is remind him we're at anchor with the boat, and that's why they were able to come up and smell into the live well. I'll walk to the front of the boat, and I'll take the bait and drop it close to the center line and then take slack so my rod can go out the side. But I want that bait drifting close to the center line of the boat, just whatever side you're on, but as close to center line. And I start walking it back. Now, watching the line so the line stays up and down. If the line starts getting ahead of me, I move with that, and I just keep moving it down. So now my bait has drifted all the way under the boat. The fish sees it drifting all the way to them, and they're much more likely to hit it. If you drop it in front of them, sometimes they're like, I don't know. They actually look at you like, yeah, I'll fall for this, but not this time. But if you go to the front of the boat and allow that bait to drift all the way through, 9 out of 10 times they eat it.
Cobia are smart fish. You know, we got dumb fish like mackerel. I mean, they're designed to, you know, swim really fast and bite stuff.
Right.
Cobias are hunters.
Yes, you know, they are.
They're stock fish. They're looking around for
Isn't
something.
Isn't ling, the crab eater, L-I-N-G? Don't they call them ling?
Yes.
Okay.
And cobia has something to do in Spanish with eels. They're eel eaters.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, they're smart fish. So they're using their brain, that bigger brains than most fish do. They're harder to fool. They're just really harder to fool because they're thinking it through. Unlike a mackerel, if it's shiny, I'm going to bite it.
Right. So it's...
And it has to do, again, you know, with survival of different fish in the area that they're living in. Mackerel, they're chasing things, and they've got to be quick, and they've got to make fast decisions to bite or not bite, and they bite. Where a cobia is like, well, maybe I should bite this, maybe I shouldn't bite this, and it doesn't look quite natural to me. And that's why you get so frustrated when that cobia is swimming around a boat and you're giving them big, juicy shrimp and nice bait. And, you know, you made a cut in the bait so all the liquid's coming out of them. And he's like, no, I don't think so. It didn't do all the things that a bait fish is supposed to do.
And I think cobia have the same thing as us. Occasionally, I do really dumb stuff.
Yes, and they get pulled out of the gene pool pretty quick.
You know, you go to work, you get done with work, you look all over for your keys, you go out to the vehicle, you open up the driver's door, you look all around the seat, in the console, everywhere around, can't find your keys, you go back into the store, you come out, you open the passenger door, you're looking for the keys, then you look up and they're hanging in the ignition. And so you close the passenger door, walk around to the driver's door, you get in, and you have to turn the vehicle off before you can get your keys out. So it sat and ran all day while you were at work. Cobia have those same moments.
Yes, where all fish do.
They're sitting there, and they will just eat the dumbest thing right there in front of them, and then the next time they're going to trick you and fool you like nothing. And I don't know why I know that.
Right. Well, this is – I don't know why you know that either, Frank.
Yes.
But this is the time, as Frank said, this is the time to go fishing. And we're going to see this weather pattern according to our weather lady here. This is going to go on for the next several weeks.
And as it gets warmer, we're going to lose this advantage. So you got a couple weeks to a month to take advantage of this. But it's not going to last forever. So if you got a boat – ignore the gas prices for one trip. Get out in the middle of the harbor. Do some trolling, bobber fishing. Get around the reefs. Just go out and give her a heck. You've got very good odds of having an excellent day. Memorable trip of lifetime stuff right now.
And it's going to be like a trip to the grocery store. There's going to be all kinds of stuff out there.
Yeah.
And the same thing along the beaches. If you don't have a boat, get out there, walk the beaches, because they're coming up close. All kinds of things coming up close that you don't normally see.
It's really an amazing time. And guess what? In 10 or 15 years, they're going to be talking about how great the fishing was here back now.
Back then, yeah.
Back now.
We're back then now.
Yeah, we're back now, right now, because every few years I hear how great the fishing was before this. And, oh, if I was only here a few years ago. Well, this is a few years ago right now. Go get it.
Hook, sinker, and line. To ease my mind.